so happened when Sanballat heard that we were rebuilding the wall that he was furious and very indignant and mocked the Jews. And he spoke before his brethren and the army of Samaria and said, "What are these feeble Jews doing? Will they fortify themselves? Will they offer sacrifices? Will they complete it in a day? Will they revive the stones from the heaps of rubbish, stones that are burned?" Now Tobiah the Ammonite was beside him, and he said, "Whatever they build, if even the fox goes up on it, he will break down their stone wall. Hear, O God, for we are despised. Turn their reproach on their own heads, and give them as plunder to a land of captivity. Do not cover their iniquity, and do not let their sin be blotted out from before you, for they have provoked you to anger before the builders." So we built the wall, and the entire wall was joined together up to half its height, for the people had a mind to work. Now it happened when Sanballat, Tobiah, the Arabs, the Ammonites, and the Ashdodites heard that the walls of Jerusalem were being restored and the gaps were beginning to be closed, that they became very angry, and all of them conspired together to come and attack Jerusalem and create confusion. Nevertheless, we made our prayer to our God, and because of them we set a watch against them day and night. Then Judah said, "The strength of the laborers is failing, and there is so much rubbish that we are not able to build the wall." And our adversary said, "They will neither know nor see anything till we come into their midst and kill them and cause the work to cease." So it was when the Jews who dwelt near them came that they told us 10 times, "From whatever place you turn, they will be upon us." Therefore I positioned men behind the lower parts of the wall at the openings, and I set the people according to their families with their swords, their spears, and their bows. And I looked and arose and said to the nobles, to the leaders, and to the rest of the people, "Do not be afraid of them. Remember the Lord, great and awesome, and fight for your brethren, your sons, your daughters, your wives, and your houses." And it happened, when our enemies heard that it was known to us, and that God had brought their plot to nothing, that all of us returned to the wall, everyone to his work. So it was from that time on that half of my servants worked at construction, while the other half held the spears, the shields, the bows, and wore armor, and the leaders were behind all the house of Judah, those who built on the wall, and those who carried burdens, loaded themselves, so that with one hand they worked at construction, and with the other held a weapon. Every one of the builders had his sword girded at his side as he built, and the one who sounded the trumpet was beside me. Then I said to the nobles, the rulers, the rest of the people, "The work is great and extensive, and we are separated far from one another on that the wall. Wherever you hear the sound of the trumpet, rally to us there. Our God will fight for us." So we labored in the work, and half of the men held the spears from daybreak until the stars appeared. At the same time, I also said to the people, "Let each man and his servant stay at night in Jerusalem, that they may be our guard by night and a working party by day." So neither I, my brethren, my servants, nor the men of the guard who followed me took off our clothes, except that everyone took them off for washing. Now we come to this evening's study on the book of Nehemiah. This evening we want to cover Nehemiah chapter 4, verse 1 to 23, which is the whole of the chapter. We come to this study, serving God in the midst of opposition. Remember, we are in the year 445 BC. So if you consider the last batch of Jews being taken away by the Babylonians, which was in 586 BC, then you know that over 100 years have gone by ever since the last batch of Jews were taken away by the Babylonians. The Babylonian Empire had fallen, and the Medo-Persian Empire had risen, which means that Nehemiah was born in Babylon. He was a new generation in that land. But Nehemiah never lost sight of the kingdom of God and the vision to want to rebuild Jerusalem. It shows that his mother, especially his parents, especially his mother, had taught him well the scriptures. The Jews have the practice that the mother would teach the children the word of God. So obviously, Nehemiah had been taught well, and Nehemiah had gone to school and had been trained, and He rose to be a very high official and a very trusted one. He was one who was chosen to be the king's cupbearer. And to be the king's cupbearer means that you are entrusted with the very important job, because by being near to the king, you could easily kill him. So you must be a trusted person. And furthermore, you are to taste the food and drink of the king if there is any suspicion of his food or drink being poisoned. So you will be the person who dies first to protect the king. So it is a very responsible job and very trusted job. And Nehemiah was the king's cupbearer at that time. And God moved Nehemiah to be concerned and burdened for the work of rebuilding the walls of Jerusalem. And the king allowed him to return. And Nehemiah returned with the third batch of Jews. And when he returned and arrived in Jerusalem, we know already that the enemies of the Jews were very unhappy. They were shaken. They were uneasy. If you look at chapter 2, verse 10, you remember the description of them. We are told, when Sanballat the Horonite, which means that he was a Moabite, because Horon was a city in Edom. So the Edomites, in Moab. So he was a Moabite. So Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite officially heard of it. They were deeply disturbed that a man had come to seek the well-being of the children of Israel. Now, how disturbed were they? Very deeply. They were deeply disturbed. They were very much disturbed. So it is described as deeply disturbed. It's not just a little bit concerned or just a passing interest. No, they were really troubled. But trouble over what? What wrong has the Jews done? It's just because here was a man sent by the king to seek the well-being of the children of Israel. So obviously the enemies of the Jews just hated the Jews simply because they were Jews. And by someone like Nehemiah standing, returning to help the Jews rebuild Jerusalem, they felt that their own position was being threatened. And we are told that there was another man aligned with them in verse 19. We are told, when Sanballat the Horonite, Tobiah the Ammonite official, and Geshem the Arab heard of it, they laughed at us and despised us and said, "What is this thing that you are doing? Will you rebel against the king?" So they were charging them with treason, insinuating that they were going against the king, at the same time that they ridiculed them, laughing at them. Now, Nehemiah was not put off by the ridicule as well as the attempt to frighten him. So you see now the enemies of the Jews were using the two common tactics used by Satan, namely to discourage God's people and to put fear in them. And we are going to see these tactics used by Satan again in the present chapter that we are studying tonight, namely chapter 4. But you see this already being shown in the earlier chapter of chapter 2, verse 20, verse 19. They were ridiculing the Jews with a view of discouraging them. They insinuated they were going against the king, trying to frighten them. They tried to discourage, they tried to put fear into Nehemiah. But Nehemiah knew Satan's devices, so he was not going to be easily put off. And you look at verse 20. So I said to them, I answered them, "The God of heaven himself will prosper us. Therefore we, his servants, will arise and build. But you have no heritage or right or memorial in Jerusalem." So Nehemiah was very firm and he held firm. He wasn't going to be affected by the attempts of the enemies to discourage him or to put fear in him. So in chapter 3, Nehemiah began to lead the Jews in the work of rebuilding the walls of Jerusalem, and various individuals, families, clans, all the leaders, they were each assigned a part of the wall to build. And when they began to build in earnest, of course, the opposition against them also began in earnest. And that is what we are going to see tonight. what we have seen already in chapter 3, that the rebuilding of the wall had begun. It was going on steadily. There was such determination in the Jews as they built. And obviously Satan was unhappy and stirred up the enemies of the Jews to act. And this is what we are going to see in tonight's chapter. And in tonight's chapter, we are going to learn lessons for ourselves, and they all will dovetail to this one main lesson, that building up the Church of Jesus Christ requires perseverance on our part and trust in God. So it is required that we persevere in doing what needs to be done, and we also need to trust in God at the same time as we build up the Church of the Lord Jesus Christ. And tonight's study breaks itself up into three main parts. In verse 1 to verse 6, we see two God-given means of service. In verse 7 to verse 12, we learn of two common weaknesses in the church. And in the remaining verses, we learn of two biblical ingredients of success. So the means of service, the weaknesses in the church, and the ingredients for success. So let us consider the first section, two God-given means of service, covering verse 1 to verse 6. And from these six verses, we learn two main points. Firstly, we must pray earnestly for strength and protection. Secondly, we must work hard to build up God's kingdom. So let us consider each in turn. The passage teaches us to pray earnestly for strength and protection. Why? Why do we need to pray earnestly for strength and protection? Because the enemies are many and the enemies are active. And not only are they many and active, they are also malicious, which means they aim to do bad to God's people. They aim to destroy God's work. And if they can't destroy, at least they want to hinder the work and make it a mess if they can. And the enemy is also strong, because behind all the enemies of the gospel is Satan himself. And don't underestimate the power of Satan. So because the enemies are actively and against the work of God, we do have to be careful. And this is what the Jews found at that time. God's people began to build in earnest, but the enemies also united together and opposed the work in earnest. If they were to attack the work separately already, it would be very daunting, with many enemies attacking at different times. But for them to be united and to be make a concerted effort to want to destroy the work of God, that was really a fearful thing to face with. Okay, and you note in verse 1, we are told Sanballat heard that we were rebuilding the wall. He was furious and very indignant. So furious is already a sufficient description of what he was like, but to say that he was very indignant shows that it was a settled case. It was not a matter of being angry and then like a flash on the pen and it's gone. No, instead it was a settled type of anger. He was angry, he showed it, but it remained with him. He was very indignant, and he began to do the two things that we have seen him trying to do when Nehemiah first arrived in Jerusalem. He tried to discourage the Jews and he tried to frighten them. So earlier in chapter 2, it was directed at Nehemiah, one person, and it did not have any effect on Nehemiah. Now that the Jews together were making a concerted effort, a united effort to rebuild the wall of Jerusalem, the enemies began to direct their attention at the Jews as a whole. And you note there in verse 2, and he spoke before his brethren and the army of Samaria and said, what are these feeble Jews doing? Will they fortify themselves? Will they offer sacrifices? Will they complete it in a day? Will they revive the stones from the heaps of rubbish, stones that are burned? You see what he did. He spoke loudly before his own people. And his own people included the army of Samaria. Obviously, he
came around with the army officers and asked the soldiers to be sent to march past them and to peer into their work and to question them, to frighten them. And he openly asked them, said these things to them in the hearing of the Jews, obviously intending them to hear so that they would be discouraged. And he ridiculed them, not with one thing or two things. You see the string of things that he insinuated about them. What are these feeble Jews doing? Yeah? So instead of saying directly to them, he said it to his own people in the hearing of the Jews. And of course, the Jews would feel attacked by such words. The Jews were looked upon as feeble. Then will they fortify themselves? And in other words, you see, you want to strengthen yourself. It shows that you know you are weak. Will they offer sacrifices? Oh, so they are going to show themselves to be so religious, are they? Will they complete it in a day? But the Jews never said they will complete it in a day. But just because Sanballat saw that they were working so hard with such determination, he ridiculed their determination and their hard work by saying they expect to finish it in a day. You know, but the Jews never claimed they were going to finish in a day. But he deliberately used words like this to needle at them, to provoke them. Will they revive the stones from the heaps of rubbish? So he called those things they use as rubbish, the stones that were burned, that have been burned. Okay? And then you consider what else was said in verse 3. Now Tobiah the Ammonite was beside him, and he said, whatever they build, if even a fox goes up on it, he will break down their stone wall. Then they must have a good laugh. You know, imagine if somebody were to put this into a film. You know, you see, you imagine the two men then laughing in glee. You know, rubbing their hands together and then put with a sneer upon their faces and at the slant in their eyes as they look at the Jews. So you can imagine how provocative they were. And this was aimed at trying to make them lose heart. And you know that when you see outward action, it must be because the person is really convinced of the work, he put his heart to it. And because he put his heart to it, you can be sure that he believes in what he's doing. Okay? So they aim straight away at their inner person, put thoughts in their mind to dampen their hearts so that their actions will be dampened as well. You see the strategy? You know, if you understand the psychological weapon that is being used, you will see how terrible these people were, how bad they were. You know? These pernicious enemies of the Jews were actually aiming to sow doubts into their mind, to weaken their hearts in order that their work might be hindered or stopped. See? And you can be sure that anywhere where God's work is in progress, Satan will be active. And from the book of Revelation, we learn that there are three very common enemies used by Satan. Satan often uses the civil authorities to harm God's people. Satan also uses false teachings, which often come very subtly appearing like true teaching, to harm God's people. And also Satan uses worldliness to weaken God's people. So these are the three common agents used by Satan. And don't be surprised if any one of them or all three are harnessed by Satan at the same time to attack. And which is more dangerous? We can argue that out. See, most people would say that heresy, false teaching, would be more dangerous compared to outright persecution. And worldliness would follow closely with heresy, a false teaching, to harm the Church of God. But whatever it is, we don't want any one of these agents of Satan to be used. We certainly wouldn't feel happy if there's persecution, outright persecution. And we wouldn't be happy if there's heresy disrupting the unity of the church. And certainly we wouldn't be happy if God's people are drawn away by worldliness. Okay? So Satan often becomes active like this. So let us be aware. And the reason why Satan is active is because God's people are active. See, Satan's agents are active in hindering the work of God, while God's people are making progress in God's work. So be sure of that. So whenever there's opposition to God's work, understand that you are making an impact on society around you in God's work. Then you note that we are weak and the task is great. We must ever be conscious of that. We don't think ourselves strong. We are weak in every way. And also we are doing an important work of God. And therefore, we have to depend on God to help us in the work. And remember that the walls of Jerusalem had not been repaired for nearly a century. And despite the fact that Ezra had returned 13 years earlier, but Ezra was able only to help the Jews in their faith, but the walls remained unattended to. And so you understand, therefore, that Nehemiah was doing God's work, and he had to make the Jews understand that they were doing God's work, an important work, and to be committed to that work, and therefore to commit everything to God in prayer. And this is where, in God's work, never remember, never forget that we are only his servants. And we have a responsibility, but we are doing his work. It is not our work. We must depend on him. And what is the point of working hard without dependence on God? Because God is not going to bless if we do it in our own strength. We do it for our own glory. We forget that it is his work. So Psalm 127 verse 1 tells us that unless the Lord blesses his work, those who labor will labor in vain. And therefore, understand this, that all the hard work of the Jews would come to nothing if not for the fact that they were trusting in God. So learn from this lessons for ourselves. Today we are engaged in the work of rebuilding or building the Church of Jesus Christ. In some places it's rebuilding, in other places we are making pioneering, doing pioneering work. So we are like Nehemiah and the Jews repairing the walls of Jerusalem. Some parts the walls have totally fallen, we have to rebuild. Other parts they are damaged, they have to be put right. So also in the work of building up the Church of Jesus Christ. And because it is a spiritual work, it is a great work. And because we are dealing with souls, it is a important work. And because we have been commanded to reach out to all the nations, we know it is really a great work. We know that it involves people in all places, and it involves all time until Jesus Christ returns. And furthermore, the Great Commission is great because it is the last command given by the Lord to the church before he was taken up to glory. For all these reasons, the command of the Lord, known as the Great Commission, is truly great. Okay? So therefore, we must learn from Nehemiah and the Jews at that time that we must depend on God to protect us, and therefore we must pray earnestly while we work. But you see, prayer alone will mean that you have failed to see the need to be responsible, to use the gifts that God has given to us to build up his kingdom. So divine sovereignty and human responsibility must be seen as friends. We must work hard to build up God's kingdom. And we must build faithfully, in other words, in God's way, to fulfill God's purpose. God's work must be done in God's way and to fulfill his purpose. So never do things our own way, never divert away to do what we want. We rather want to do what God wants. And therefore, you see that the Jews have each been assigned a portion of the wall to build. Yeah? And note that they were filling up all the gaps and putting back all the parts that needed to be put. And even the doors are mentioned, the bolts and the bars are mentioned. If you look at chapter 3, verse 3, you note that these are mentioned, which shows the details. They didn't do things just roughly. See? And look at verse 6 again. See? The same thing is mentioned. And look at verse 14. The same thing is mentioned. We are told they built and hung its doors with its bolts and bars. Now, why such details? Why not just say they rebuilt the wall and it's understood the gates will be there, the bolts will be in place, the bars will be in place? See? Building the wall is one thing, okay? But building it well is another thing. So you may have done the job, but have you done it well? So first we ask the question, have you done the job? You may say, oh yes, I've done it. But have you done it well? That is the question. Then in doing God's work or obeying God's command, have you really obeyed? You may claim yes, but you have obeyed it generally, like Saul in 1 Samuel chapter 15. God told him to destroy the Amalekites because the Amalekites for centuries have sinned against God and they are now dedicated to God for destruction. That means there's no turning back. God has already set them aside to be destroyed. The period of grace for them is over. But Saul was going to be used as the king to lead the Israelites to destroy the Amalekites. But what did Saul do? He allowed the king and some of the soldiers to escape. He kept the goats, the sheep, oxen, apparently for sacrifice. When challenged by Samuel, he said, oh, this is to sacrifice to God. Okay? But that is not true obedience. You obey in general, but you didn't pay attention to the particulars. So what is the point of offering sacrifices to God when your heart is not truly submitted to Him? See? So these are lessons for us. When we obey God's commands, our heart must be in what we are doing. We don't obey just generally, but we obey well. And there is a lesson to us in how we serve the Lord, in evangelism, in teaching, outreach, whatever we do, even in the basic work of cleaning the place of meeting or in cooking or whatever else we do. We don't want to do a shoddy work of things. See? Make sure that things are tidy, neat, really as it should be. Don't just do things generally and say it's done. See? Learn from this. And I would say that the more spiritually mature you become, the more tidy you will be in whatever you do for God. The more concerned you will be in wanting to do things well. See? When you are young as a Christian, when you have not grown much spiritually, see, these are of no concern. See? But as you grow spiritually, you come to realize that you want to bear good witness and you want to do things well for the one you love. See? A person whom you love, you want to do well for him or for her. But the God whom you can't see, you don't do well. See? We must remember that God should be first in our life and therefore we must do things well for Him. So that is why I say that there is a clear connection between spiritual maturity and doing well for God. So the work for God was done with the understanding that it was for their God. And remember the teaching in 1 Corinthians chapter 3. See, all of us have faith in Jesus Christ. So our life is built on that one foundation, namely Jesus Christ. There's no other foundation we can build on. All other foundations will not save us. But how do the believers build? Some with wood, hay, and straw, which are easily burned up when judgment day comes. Others will build with gold, silver, and precious stones. And remember, gold fears no fire, you see? So gold, when heated up, at the most it melts and all the dross will be burned away, but it becomes purer. See, gold, silver, precious stones are those things that will withstand the fire of judgment. See? So will your work last? See? So what sort of work are you doing for God? Are they work that will last? And certainly we don't want to be those who build with wood, hay and straw. We want to be those who build with gold, silver and precious stones. And then there's a need not only to build faithfully but to build actively. The Jews really did their part each, except for a few, as we have seen in the previous chapter. Look at chapter 3 again, verse 5. You note that all the people worked hard, but there were some softies and some dandies, some sissies, you know, who thought themselves too high, too noble, too good to dirty their hands. Look at verse 5. Next to them, the Tekoites made repairs, but their nobles did not put their shoulders to the work of the Lord. And in fact, when we studied chapter 3, we learned that there is a possibility that some of these were aligned with the enemies, and therefore they were not willing to help in the work of building up the walls of Jerusalem. And that is, of course, bad. That means they were Jews, but they were betraying their Jews. They were supposed to be God's people, and they were in a better position to use their money and their influence to be of help. But instead, they thought too highly of themselves. They were not ready to dirty their hands. Okay? So that is not good. Yeah? But the rest of the Jews continued working actively. They were not going to be discouraged by the few who were not up to par. See? They were not going to be discouraged by those few. See? And this is where we learned the importance of not to be easily discouraged by others. For ourselves, we want to make sure that we work hard, we work well for our God. And the New Testament constantly urges us not to be weary in doing good. Galatians chapter 6 verse 9, 2 Thessalonians chapter 3 verse 13. In any church, there will be those who are not aware or not bothered about how their lives affect others. There are always such people, see. And often their lives are shoddy. Their Christian life is really very discouraging to others. And this is where we must learn from tonight's passage not to allow the few in the church to discourage us. We must continue to do what we believe to be right. And if one or two refuse to put their shoulders to the work, we, the rest, will do it. And although we feel it sometimes, how we wish that these people would just come and help a little. It will make the work lighter, see? But we don't want to be hindered in the work just because of the one or two. There were these friends from UK who were called to be missionaries in this part of the world. Then, before they came to this part of the world, they were invited to speak to a group of students, and I was in the midst of them, and one question put to them was, what made them want to be missionaries to Asia? Then they said that they sensed the burden of things. They said the West had all the privileges, all the good teachers, all the good books, a rich history of Christianity, but the East is so lacking in all this. So although they are aware that the West need missionaries as well, they feel that it is like 9 persons at one end of the lock while there's one person at the other end. So they want to go over to help the one person at the other end of the lock. You know, and that picture remained with me because in the younger days, we used to chop firewood when the old rubber plantation had their trees cut down so that new ones could be planted or replanted with oil palm instead. Those rubber trees that were cut down would be used as firewood. Anybody could go and chop the branches and trunks and carry them home to be used as firewood. And we used to do that, see. we went and used our long saw, and then one at each end of the saw, and we pull, and pull, and then the trunk would cut. And once the trunks are cut, then we would carry. You know, we normally roll up our shirt and put on our shoulders, you see, and two persons carry, one on each end. And you know how heavy it was to carry a log like that. And despite the padding under your shoulders, it hurt. See, and we carry home. See, we were young, of course. You know, but the point is that the lesson is there. Whenever one person extra came to help you at one end, you feel the relief. You know, how much lighter it was. See, and you just think. See, if there's one extra person at each end, the work is halved. Halved, you know. Half is a big amount. See, imagine only one person at each end has to bear, let us say, 100 pounds weight. See, but when you have another person at each end, it's half, so it is only 50 pounds. Wow, big difference, you know. And so you can imagine in God's work, when you don't put your share of the contribution to the work, it has its effect. But understand this, the rest of us are not going to be held back by you. Yes, the rest of us are not going to be discouraged by you. We make up our mind, especially after a study like this tonight, we make up our mind that we are not going to be discouraged by the one or two who are always found in any congregation. Somehow their spirit is not right. Somehow they are not up to mark. You see, somehow they just give excuses, and they are always the ones who are not found when their help is needed. See? So we don't want to be discouraged. We must not grow weary in doing good. Okay? So there then are the two God-given means of service. We pray earnestly to God for strength and protection. We work hard to build up His kingdom. Then we move to the second section, two common weaknesses in the church, verse 7 to verse 12. The first, as we have noted, is discouragement over the work, and the second is fear of the enemies. Look at verse 7. You see there in chapter 4, verse 7, and it happened when Sanballat, Tobiah, the Arabs, the Ammonites, and the Ashdodites heard that the walls of Jerusalem were being restored and the gaps were beginning to be closed, that they became very angry. So if they had been angry before, they were now even more angry. Yeah? And you can imagine that they became more active in wanting, more determined in wanting to destroy the work. And now they were prepared not only to ridicule the Jews, but they were prepared to attack them. And we are told in verse 8, and all of them, that means they conspired together now. They conspired together to come and attack Jerusalem and create confusion. Wow. They're getting bolder and bolder now. And note that this time there were additional enemies, the Ashdodites, who were not mentioned before. And Ashdod was, of course, the main town, an ancient main town of the Philistines. So the Philistines were now joining them in this. Now, in the past, they would be enemies of one another. The Arabs would be Arabs. The Arabs were the Midianites, or also known as the Ishmaelites. And they were enemies of the Jews. The Philistines were enemies of the Jews. But we never read of the Philistines and the Ishmaelites joining forces together. Then the Moabites and the Ammonites, they were related to the Jews, but they were their enemies. Just like the Edomites, they were related to the Jews, but they were their enemies. The Edomites were descendants of Esau, Jacob and Esau, so they were descendants of Esau. The Ammonites and the Moabites were descendants of the two daughters of Lot, who was the nephew of Abraham. See? So these were related to the Jews by blood, but throughout their history, they were enemies of the Jews. Yeah? And they had never really been close to the Midianites. There were, when the Jews wanted to move into the land of Canaan, then the Moabites joined forces with the Midianites to attack the Jews. So only when they wanted to attack their common enemies, they joined forces. And you see a similar thing happening here. Now even the Philistines were united with them. And we see this phenomenon in the days of the Lord Jesus Christ. In Mark chapter 12, verse 13, we learn of the Pharisees and the Herodians united together because they were angry at the Lord and they plotted to destroy the Lord. See, at other times they were never good friends, but because they look upon the Lord Jesus Christ as their common enemies, they joined forces and became good friends, all with a view of destroying the Lord. Yeah? So don't be surprised, therefore, that this thing happens and suddenly you find that what were originally separate groups suddenly coming together, combining force to attack us. Yeah. And you note that the Jews succumb this time. You look at verse 10, then Judah said, the strength of the laborers is failing, and there's so much rubbish that we are not able to build the wall. And this is mentioned immediately after the report that the Jews, the enemies of the Jews, were gathering force to attack the Jews. And in verse 9, we say, nevertheless, we made our prayer to our God, and because of them, we set a watch against them day and night. So we thought that something has been done. But in verse 10, we see that some of the Jews succumb to the situation. Oh, you know, there's so much work to be done, see, in such a situation. Yeah, before that, there was no complaint. But now, they seem to have been shaken by the enemies combining forces to try to disrupt the work. So they fell to discouragement. Satan scored his first victory, causing the Jews to be discouraged. And discouraged over what? Over such a petty matter. See, they were saying there's so much rubbish and we are unable to build a wall. If you say, you know, the enemies keep knocking down what we have built, then we can understand. Or the enemies came and pushed us away, then we can understand. You see, but you know, with such a petty excuse, so much rubbish, okay, and the work is difficult. See, and so beware of this first weapon, common weapon of Satan. Satan uses two very common weapons, discouragement and the fear of man. Fear, so discouragement. When you are discouraged, there is a tendency for discouragement to spread to others. So you must be very careful, okay? And when you are discouraged, beware that it gets worse and you become bitter in your heart, see? When you become bitter in your heart, you discover you begin to keep away from other people. You begin to nurse your perceived wounds. See? What you treat as wrong done to you. But when you sit down and ask yourself, you see, before when everything was well, you don't regard that as a problem. But now, because your heart is being affected by discouragement, then you are growing bitter. And then you find fault with what would normally be not a problem. So a small thing became a big thing now, see? And then subconsciously you are blaming others. First you blame your situation, then you begin to blame others, see? And you know what it is like. Sheep that are healthy will keep together and graze together. But when one sick, sheep is sick, you discover that sheep will keep himself clear from the others and eat alone. Okay? So you might claim that, you know, I'm still reading my Bible, but why are you attending meetings less? Why are you keeping away from God's people? See? Why are you disappearing immediately the meeting is over? Why do you come late just as the meeting begins or even after the meeting begins? The reason is because your heart is growing cold. See? You want to interact with people as little as possible. You claim you're okay. You're still attending meeting, what? You're reading your Bible at home, you see? But you come just in time or after the meeting starts, so you don't have to interact with people. The moment the meeting is over, you disappear because you don't want to interact with people. See? And the psychology of things is easy to understand. See? You're only fooling yourself. You know, you convince yourself that that is not the case. But everyone can see what is happening. Don't tell me the shepherd does not know that the sheep is sick. When the sheep begins to eat by himself, it is contrary to the character of a sheep. So if you are a sheep, if you belong to Jesus Christ, and you begin to separate yourself from the others, we know that something is wrong. Okay? You're not well spiritually. Okay? So take heed. Take heed. And we are always nursing our perceived wounds. We think that we are wounded. We think others have wronged us. You see? We look upon things as so bad, you see, and keep clear of things. We try to say, no, nothing is wrong, you see. And basically, what are you wanting? What are you trying to accomplish? You see, and this is where you have to stop and ask yourself, you see. You want people to pity you, to sympathize with you, to come and pay more attention to you, you see. Or what, you see? What exactly do you want? See? And people can help you to a certain extent. The church has its duty to draw near to you, to do what it can. Members of the church will minister to you the best they can. See? But you must understand that your attitude of heart makes all the difference. See? If you don't realize that you are sick, if you don't acknowledge the fact that you are spiritually backslidden, if you don't repent and put things right, you discover you are the loser. You are the loser. The Church of Jesus Christ will continue to exist on this earth. It will continue to grow until He returns. With you or without you, see, it will continue and it will grow, see. But in the end, you will have to answer before the Lord. And this is where we must be careful of this. So let us not lose sight of God's glory and His kingdom. Let us not be so inward-looking and so self-centered, nursing our own wounds. Let us rise out of the situation and say, you know, hey, what's happening to me? See, I'm backslidden. My heart has grown cold. I'm not growing spiritually. And it's not to my good. See? And in the end, I have to answer before the Lord. Let us wake up. Let us wake up. Okay? Then the second weapon used by the enemies is fear. No, we fear many things. We fear being attacked, so we fear for our lives, we fear for our family members, we fear about our career, we fear about our reputation. We fear this, we fear that. And that's what the enemies want to do to us, to instill fear in us. And you note there in verse 11, and our adversary said, they will neither know nor see anything till we come into their midst and kill them and cause the works to cease. The words they used were becoming sharper, clearer, more bold. See? And obviously they were saying this openly in the hearing of the people. Eh? And to the right people so that the words will be conveyed to others. And they were very smart. They were masters of deception. They were masters of psychological warfare. See? And you see the effect in verse 12. So it was when the Jews who dwelt near them came that they told us 10 times. 10 times does not mean exactly 10. 10 is just a round number to say many times. From whatever place you turn, they will be upon us. Wow, they are frightened already. See? So these Jews live near to the enemies. The enemies just passed the word around, insinuated against them. Ah, these Jews, they are our enemies. We will go against them. We will attack. You see, soon enough, let's see. So we are already planning. See? Maybe tonight, you see. Wow, these Jews got very uptight, quickly conveyed the information to the other Jews and to the other Jews and to the leaders. You see? And the leaders are receiving this information. They're receiving this information. And what the enemies want is to cause you to be rattled, to be shaken, and you rush to try and calm down around the people, and you get agitated yourself, and you forget that you are already being undermined by the enemies. You see, once you begin to fear, you have lost half the battle. Yes, that's what the enemy wanted to accomplish, you see. And they really succeeded. They spread fear to just some, and these others will spread the news to others, causing others to fear. And you must understand, therefore, see, this is a strategy used by the enemies of the gospel. Of Sun Tzu's art of war, go study, even though the world knows strategy, see, the importance of intelligence. You know, intelligence meaning gathering information. See, the importance of psychological warfare. See, spies and counter spies. Yeah. So this sort of ideas and concepts, you must understand. Don't live in your own world without understanding what is happening in politics around us. Don't want to live in your world without understanding what is happening in society, what's happening around the world. And understand the underlying principles, that this is information and misinformation. A red herring being thrown out in order for you to chase until you are exhausted. You see, you understand what is a red herring, don't you? It's something to mislead you, you see. So there was this friend who works in the research department of a big company in Japan. He said when their company was pursuing one line of research, they knew that their competitor would be sending out spies to snoop around. Any trade conventions or exhibitions, potential customers will come, ask questions, but their competitors will act as customers also and ask questions and so on. See? And the reason is because they wanted to know the direction you are going, which next model you are going to improve on. And so the competitor is going to make sure that they come up quickly with something similar and better than yours and faster so that they capture the market. See? So what this friend said is that when they were going along this line, they were aiming to produce this product. You see? They issue a red herring. They try to bring brochures. They try to announce and hint that something else is going to come out. You see? And this is to mislead the competitor, thinking that his company is going to produce something else, when in fact they were going to produce this other product. So he laughed at how they constantly threw out the red herring to mislead the competitors. Now you must understand that this is psychological warfare. This is issuing information with a view of misinforming. You see? And that's why there's such a thing as information and misinformation. You see? To mislead you. Okay? And the enemies can use this. Right? When the church is growing, when branches are being started, when a new church is planted, and another church is planted, and that grouping of churches is becoming vibrant and making headway. You know? Now there are enemies of the gospel who don't like that. So what they can do is they will see, that person is an elder of the church. He's a prominent elder of that church. So where does he work? Oh, he works in perhaps, you know, which company? Then they will send their men in, you see. And their men in will go into that company and perhaps, you know, get to know you and with a product to sell and so on, talk to you. And then along the way, oh, you're Christian, you go to that church. You know, oh, by the way, you know, I used to know Pastor so-and-so, you know. Oh, he's my pastor, you know. Oh, you didn't know, you know, last time he was like this, right? He did this and that. Oh, like that. No, cannot be. You see, you may protest, cannot be, but you have already allowed him to sow a doubt into your mind about your own pastor. So when you come back, there's this doubt in you. And soon, that doubt, if you are not careful, that doubt is allowed to grow. See? And soon you become a difficult person. And what happens is soon that church breaks up. You see? Now you must understand all these tactics of the enemies of the gospel. That is why, leaders of the church especially must be more intelligent than that. Why is that the children of the world are often wiser than the children of light? You see, we are so naive, not understand all this. Keeping to ourselves, reading our Christian books those are good, but you know, you're living like a frog in the well. You're not concerned about the things that's happening around you. You don't understand the currents and counter currents that are operating. See, you don't understand that the enemies of the gospel can be attacking the church using all these tactics. So be very careful, okay? Be very careful. Learn from this. And here you see this happening. The enemies try to discourage the work. The enemies try to instill fear into the people. And the people succumb first to discouragement, then to fear, see? And so Satan scored his second victory. So we must learn that this is a common way by which Satan attacked God's people, especially leaders of the church. If you are a person who is not prone to fear, you will be prone to discouragement. You must be very careful. If you are a person who doesn't seem to be easily discouraged, the next thing is fear. So often, one of these two weapons will be used by Satan. Okay? And you know what it is, right? When a person is fearful, he's crippled in his ability to be useful in God's work. Okay. There was a film show of this kung fu expert who pretended that he didn't know kung fu. So he was tested on by the enemies, and you know, in those days, the test would be that the enemy will suddenly pull out his sword, try to chop you. But at the moment when the sword just touches the neck, he stops, you see. And the reason why he does that is to see your reaction. And if you're a kung fu person, you will defend yourself and you counterattack, you see. And straight away the enemy knows you are actually pretending not to know kung fu. You actually are a kung fu man. But this person, his kung fu level is much higher than normal, such that when the test came to him, he really was able to control himself and acted as though he didn't know kung fu. He was nearly killed. See? So he hid his skill for so long until his friends, one by one, were being killed. And finally, he couldn't stand it anymore. He felt that the time has come. Even though he swore never to use his skill anymore, but now he must use it to avenge his friends. But when he came out to fight the enemies, he was wounded and soon he died. And the reason why he was wounded and died? Because his skills had been left dormant for so long, you see? And all his bones were creaking, the muscles were not toned, so he couldn't use his skills well. See, he was not in training, you see? Now, we don't want to be like that. God gives us gifts. And for whatever reason, we hide our skills, we don't want to use it. Our false humility, which is actually a form of pride, see, let others do it, you see, and you don't show yourself, and so on. Okay. And when the time comes, when you really want to be useful to the Lord, you discover you're unable to be as useful as you could have been. Circumstances have changed, situations really are no more the same, you see. That's why every opportunity is unique. See? Really, every opportunity is a one of its own kind. When there's an opportunity to be useful to God, be useful. Don't say, next time, when the same opportunity comes again. The next time, the same opportunity, but it's different, because it is a different opportunity. You see, so I fear that a useful person can be destroyed either by fear or by discouragement. See, out of fear, fear of your reputation, fear of your loved ones, fear of whatever, you don't act. Or out of discouragement. When you are discouraged, you know, all the gifts are there. All the opportunities have been provided by God for you to serve in. See? But when you are discouraged, you have no heart to do anything. See? No heart. No motivation. See? You're just dampened, cold, flaccid, useless. See? Instead of being vibrant, fresh, see, strong, and be ready to be used, you become useless. Okay, understand this. We move on to two biblical ingredients of success. The Jews trusted in the sovereign God, and they were able to keep united as a people. Thankfully, Nehemiah wasn't carried away by discouragement or fear. To say that he was not affected would not be true. He was a man of like nature as we are, and we are affected by circumstances around us. See? But he decided to act on what was right. See? It's like you say, the person is so courageous. Why do you say he's courageous? Oh, he's fearless. He doesn't fear anything. But that is not true. If you find a truly fearless man, a man without fear, he's not truly man. He's from an alien world. He's a monster. You see, all men will fear to some degree. But we say the biblical definition of courage is the ability to do what is right, even though we fear. Okay? That is the biblical definition of courage. A godly man will have some degree of fear or some degree of discouragement in him, but he will always want to act and do what is right, even though he is fearful, even though he is discouraged. And Nehemiah was not going to allow discouragement or fear to prevent him from doing what was right. So he did what was right. Okay? And he therefore assigned the people to do what was needed. In verse 13, therefore I positioned men behind the lower parts of the wall at the openings, and I set the people according to their families with their sword, their spears, and their bows. And I looked and arose and said to the nobles, to the leaders, and to the rest of the people, do not be afraid of them. Remember the Lord, great and awesome. Fight for your brethren, your sons, your daughters, your wives, and your houses. It's almost like here is a wall, and the enemy is coming. See, now you can't retreat, because if you retreat, the enemies will have a good time chasing after you and killing you from behind, and row by row you will be chopped down. See. So what do you do? Then you have to face the enemy. And if you have to face the enemy, why don't you fight with the intention to win? Why don't you give of your best? See? And think, if you succumb, see, the next thing that will happen is your wives, your children will be taken by them, or killed by them. Then the land will be overrun by the enemies. See? So it is like the kingdom of God. See, we are not here to compete with other religions. But if the truth is not proclaimed, see, the vacuum is left for falsehood to come in. So the heresies and false religions will come in to the place where the truth is not. And often it is when we try to preach the truth, we discover there appears to be so much competition. Then what do? Want to retreat? No, hold your ground. Often the one who is able to persevere is the one who will win. There was this story of two brothers who went fishing in the sea, and the waves became rough and the boat overturned, you see. The older brother was encouraging the younger brother, hold on, you know, they were clinging on to the overturned boat. And the older brother was swept away. The younger brother was so troubled and had to seek psychiatric treatment. And as the psychiatrist went through treating him, and one day helped him to see, the reason why you survive is because you held on just that bit longer. See? It's not because your brother sacrificed himself for you, no. It's because you held on longer. See? So it helped him to come to his senses and said, whatever his brother had done wouldn't have affected him. It's more him holding on. But you remember the story of William Carey in India? He spent years translating books, putting down the new words into a dictionary with a view of translating the Bible. So the years of studying the language and producing the dictionaries were one night burned down. A fire came, and then the fire just swallowed up everything. They had no time to rescue anything. And imagine the disappointment in Carey. And others will be broken, crying, and give up hope. See? But Carey started all over again, translating the same thing and producing the same dictionaries. And of course, this time it took a shorter time because it was the second time round. And it was better, see. And then from there he could proceed translating the Bible. And in the end he translated the Bible into 32 different languages in India. Okay. And of that fire, he could say, he was a plodder. He was a person who wouldn't give up easily. He may be slow, but he would plod at it, doing what he believed to be right. See? So often it is the one who could persevere doing what is right. See, that is the one who will win. See? It's not because your strength is greater than others, your intelligence is more than others. See? It's not because you're better in any way, but it's simply the ability to persevere, trusting the Lord, doing what is right. See? And then you saw the enemies coming, and he exhorted them. And in the end, it was the enemies who backed down. Verse 15, and it happened when our enemies heard that it was known to us and that God had brought their plot to nothing, that all of us returned to the wall, everyone to his work. So who won? God's people won. Nehemiah was wise in encouraging the people to hold on, to trust the Lord. So don't give up. Trust the Lord. We can't retreat. Therefore, why not we stay and continue to face the enemy and do what is right? See? Then the second thing is the unity of God's people. Nehemiah assigned them, divided them into two groups. One worked, the other held weapons ready to defend against the enemies. Verse 16, see. And verse 17 has given rise to C.H. Spurgeon's magazine called The Sword and the Trowel. And the magazine continues to be published by the Metropolitan Tabernacle in London up to this day. In verse 17, those who built on the wall and those who carried burdens loaded themselves so that with one hand they worked at construction and with the other held a weapon. So with one hand they were repairing the wall, with the other they held a weapon. In other words, it's not that they literally held and used one hand to work. What it's meant is that they had their weapon by the side, and then they knew that at any moment they need to use the weapon. So they were working hard, but with the consciousness that the enemies would attack at any time. See? So in such a situation, they work. And wouldn't that slow down the work? Of course it would have slowed down the work, but it made the people more determined that they would do the work. It might take longer, but they would do the work. They were not going to be hindered in what they believed to be right. See? Then, of course, at night, see, they would be tired out, they would be sleeping. So then the enemies would attack. So what Nehemiah did was to ask those men who lived outside the city walls not to go home during this period of repairing the wall. You all stay back. See, so that there's extra people, one group will guard, be on guard, the other group will sleep. Then in the daytime, you can be rotate, yeah, and be part of the working party. So there were more men around, even at night. Okay. So all in all, this arrangement allowed them to be able to complete the wall. And throughout, you note that they were trusting the Lord while they work. Look at verse 20. See? Wherever you hear the sound of the trumpet, rally to us. Our God will fight for us. But you think that they wouldn't fight. What is meant is that we fight, but trusting the Lord. So the Lord will fight for us as we fight. Similarly, we work, trusting the Lord, and the work the Lord will work in us. Okay? So divine sovereignty and human responsibility do not clash at all. Divine sovereignty encompasses human responsibility. And so together the church worked. They worked as a body. They were not in a position to quarrel with one another in a situation like that. See? They were in no position now to pick on little things. They were able to see that their survival was at stake. The work of God was at stake. They were able to rise above personal problems to see the bigger picture. See? And as a result, each one contributed his part. Just like what we learn from the New Testament, the church is a body with many members. See? And each member is part of the body. And God has given us gifts to serve in the church. And each of us, if we were to use our gifts, then we will be able to accomplish much. You know the story of how England had to fight against the Spanish. And as they came, Admiral Nelson issued out the signal on his ship. In those days, they used flags, color of flags, to be codes to form a message. And the message he sent out was, England expects this day everyone to do his duty. Okay. And the people took heart. Yes, the battle seems to be so great before us. One person cannot survive in such a work. But when they saw the message, they just focused on doing each his part. See, if you are the one shooting the cannons, then you focus on shooting the cannons. But not all is going to shoot the cannon. There are others who are rowing, so you focus on rowing. See? There are others who are doing other little chores. You do your part, because if that part is not done, then it affects the whole. But each one doing his part resulted in the battle won. Okay? And so the same can be said of the church. If only we will capture this vision that the church is a body, each person, each member forms part of the body. Each has a part to play. And in the end, you look at verse 23. So neither I, my brethren, my servants, nor the men, the guard who followed me, took off our clothes, except that everyone took them off for washing. You almost want to smile or even laugh out loud, you know. LOL, laugh out loud, you see. See, even this detail is mentioned, that they didn't take off their clothes except for washing. See? But on the more serious side, you discover that everyone really did his part. Even Nehemiah, you know, coordinating the whole work, was so busy that they had no time to take off their clothes except for washing. They wanted to be ready for action all the time. No changing into pajamas, no wearing your sarong, nothing. Because if the enemy attack, your sarong will be a hindrance. So no, in your working clothes, all ready. See. So that was how they succeeded in rebuilding the wall. So let us look at what we have studied. There are two God-given means of service. Namely, to pray earnestly for strength and protection, and to work hard to rebuild, to build up his kingdom. There are two common weaknesses in the church. discouragement over the work, and fear of the enemies. There are two biblical ingredients of success: trust in the sovereign God and remain united as we serve our God. When applied to the Great Commission of building the Church of Jesus Christ, we must have a clear vision for missions. We must have a true burden for souls, and we must truly remain united in spirit. And we must persevere on doing what we believe to be right as we trust in God to give us the strength to protect us. And we want to do all things to the glory of our God. So with that, we come to the end of tonight's study. Are there questions or comments?